Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here at Francis Shop. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, Mark, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well, Francis. How are you?
I'm well indeed. You've got some... You got a whole bunch of papers in front of you. What are we talking about today?
Well, I was leafing through a couple of the food magazines.
Well, that's a particularly bad food magazine. We're not going to say what it is, but I see what you've got there.
Well, actually, this was in more than one food magazine, believe it or not.
Yeah?
It was Diet Coke has put out a big new advertising thing. And one of the things they're advertising, one of the dishes that they're advertising is celery root soup with Fuji apples and 24-karat gold. It's called a star-studded menu for Oscar
I
night.
I hate that stuff.
Celery root?
No.
Fuji apples.
No. When people put gold in their food.
Yeah, no bling for my soup. Thanks very much.
I got gold in my watch. I don't need it on my food. And it's just so, I mean, I hate gold. I mean, it's almost, it's kind of pretty on chocolates, but it's getting out of hand. You know, what is that liquor? Goldschlager that has little gold flecks? Do you want a drink or a snow globe? What is it that you want?
Okay, why are we putting, is it so you get filled up and there's no calories? Is that
Here's
the idea?
Here's the deal. If you have gold thin enough, basically make a very thin gold foil. It's digestible. It's not digestible, but it passes. It's inert. It passes through your system. It's you know, comes out the other side. You know what I'm saying?
It's inert. Stop talking.
But, okay, so you can eat gold. But why would you want to eat gold? It doesn't taste like anything, and it's a waste of, I don't know, gold. But I don't understand.
I don't understand the purpose of it as an ingredient. Is it to make you feel more special?
It's to make, it's like
to make
I'm
you
rich.
Feel more important, to make you say, look, I can throw gold anywhere. I can eat
right,
it. I can burn my money, and I can eat my gold.
We have a special tonight at Stage Left Restaurant. It's got creme brulee. And we're going to put a $100 bill on the top next to sugar. She's going to burn it to bits right in front, and you can eat the ashes from your $100 bill. Why are we eating gold? It's stupid.
It's really, really...
You know, there's a liquor out there called Goldschlager. I think it's vanilla. Is it vanilla? Or
I don't
cinnamon?
Know. Cinnamon is
cinnamon.
What it is.
But it's got flecks of real gold. Why do we want gold to eat?
I don't get it.
Okay, invest in? Sure. Coins, I got it. Gold tips on my stereo plugs? Okay. But why? I don't want it on my soup, and I don't want it on my desserts. I just, it's decadent and wasteful and stupid.
Let's, you know, they call them precious metals because they're precious.
All right, I got one for you. I got the news today. This is from an old issue of the Montgomery News. Somebody brought this into the restaurant for me, February 07. FBI investigates animal rights groups' vandalism at Griggstown Quail Farm. This is a little New Jersey Rama here. Mm-hmm. Animal rights activists, members of the North American Animal Liberation Front, ALF, vandalized the Griggstown Quail Farm.
Hold on. Wasn't ALF that little guy from another planet on
television
show from way back when?
Yeah, he's protected too. anyway, so ALF, these guys vandalized the Griggstown Quail Farm on December 18th. Now, this is a small farmer. He's not a big corporate agribusiness guy, and he runs a very humane farm. We know him. We buy from him.
I've been to the farm, okay? It is the quail and turkey, they're walking around the farm. You talk about free range, it's as free range as they get.
If I got to come back in my next life as a quail, I want to come back and be in his quail farm. Okay. Here's from the ALF's website. Last night we gave an early Christmas present to around 250 of our friends, meaning the quail, at the Griggstown Quail Farm in Princeton, New Jersey. After clipping through the fencing, we cut out large sections of the canopy covering the three pens and then flushed several hundred quail, pheasants, and partridges out into the starry sky and freedom.
Free, be free!
The farm is located by a waterway and open fields, and we wish our friends the best of luck in establishing the new lives. One problem, you ALF idiots. None of the released birds is going to survive. Do you know why? They're a domesticated species, and none of them, that's right, none of them are able to feed themselves unless there's a guy walking around with a corn
feeder.
Somebody
has been feeding these birds everywhere they go. Okay,
okay, so
they
not
spill
only...
corn on the ground, and the birds eat it. And
in
it's
nature,
just,
no one spills corn on the ground.
And it's just there, and it's Christmas time. Do you think there's corn laying on the ground for the birds to eat?
So the birds are just congregating in the roads with the inevitable results, and even the ones who don't just die off in the trees.
Birds.
Okay.
So the birds are now hit by cars. The birds are starving to death.
They die, okay? Birds do not go to Florida and die in their sleep with their relatives around them. In nature, animals die a violent death 99% of the time. And, you know, when you release it from a farm, if you release a food animal from a farm, even if it could fend for itself, that bird gets eaten by something else anyway, okay? It does not retire, all right, and play golf. Now, you're hurting a small farmer here. And by the way, you ALF idiots, if you would like to know, you know, go have the cojones to go and take on Tyson, who de-beaked their chickens keep them in battery cages.
And actually, the person who came into the restaurant and handed me this article, you know, I had that exact conversation with, you know, you really want to do something, you really want to change the world, then go and take on one of these large agribusiness pork farms or
that is being cruel to animals.
The CAFOs, confined animal
feeding operations.
Go and take on one of these. Go and take on.
And they're not hard to find because that's how 90% of the meat we get comes from, especially in birds, comes from confined animal feeding operations.
Go and take on one of these bird factories.
Yeah, but that's not easy. You can't, like, do that on a weekend, you know, where you... Okay, you're such idiots, you didn't even research the fact that when you released these birds, they were going to die. So what you did was you shortened these birds'
Shame
lives.
On you. Shame on you.
And then what you did was you made sure these birds starved to death in the cold
or got hit by a car. Who's cruel?
Instead of being humanely killed and being eaten by food. And... Now we have created more demand because more people, because I'm still ordering quail
exactly,
every week, Alfie.
Exactly, because they still have a demand. You know, I talk about the PETA guys. One of my favorite
PETA
little...
PETA is the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals.
One of my favorite things that they do is they take a like paint and throw it on somebody wearing a mink coat while they're walking down the street. And my answer to that is, okay, so now the insurance company pays the person to replace their mink coat. They replace their mink coat, and you've now killed another 100 mink.
And is it,
you're doing it wrong.
There's a difference between protest to make a change and a temper tantrum. And now the other thing about it is these farmers – look, if you believe that killing animals for food is wrong, period, end of story – then that's what you believe. But don't pretend like you're going for the people who are cruel to animals because you're so weak and lame that the people who are really cruel to animals, Tyson, ConAgra, big factories like that, you're too wimpy to take them on. So you go after some small family farmer at the Griggstown Quail Farm in Princeton, New Jersey, who is raising birds the way that, you know, that animals are the most humane way that you can raise animals that are meant for food without large bits of antibiotic and hormones in their feed, free-ranging, treats them well. Here's the deal.
The temperament here of some of these groups is that the life of the animal is equal to the life of a person.
It's crazy. I got two things for you. One is this guy was hurt. It was 2,500 birds that may have been lost with a market value of $80,000. Think about that for a small farmer who's trying to make it. Second thing is go to ALF's website. They list a lot of places that serve foie gras, for example, and foie gras farmers are another type of farming that really is humane that these guys pick on that's not. Use their list of restaurants not to go to. As restaurants to go to. That's what we do. Whenever I go to Florida, for example, Alpha Florida, ALF is the Alpha Florida, I use their list of restaurants not to patronize to patronize. I suggest you do the same thing. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1115. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Tanya Steele. Tanya Wenman Steele is the editor-in-chief of the award-winning Epicurious.com. You can check it out on your web browser at home. It's Condé Nast's premier food website. It incorporates editorial content from Gourmet and Bon Appetit and Self magazines, as well as original articles only on Epicurious.com. Before Epicurious.com, Tanya was the New York editor of Bon Appetit magazine for 10 years.
Tanya, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great. You know, it's funny. We have had people from – we haven't had anybody from Self, but we certainly had folks from Gourmet and Bon Appetit. Ruth Reichel joined us on the show a while back. And what I think is very interesting, as we're in a new medium – of course, we're in broadcast radio, which is not exactly a new medium – but I would say the majority of our listeners are now listening to us via the computer. It's always interesting to talk to food bloggers. We have Andrea Strong from thestrongbuzz.com comes on once in a while. And epicurious.com, that's a pretty powerful site, but it's also a site that is owned by Condé Nast. So it's sort of bridging the gap between the print media and the new world of food media on the web. What's that like being in the nexus of all that?
And is the gap getting shorter?
You know, it's a great question. Having been on the print side for 20 years, so I'm an old fogey, it's actually been quite an education for me to think in terms of web 2.0. So I have to say that the gap is getting shorter, and the way that we are all interested in getting our news and our information and everything that we love and are passionate about is now very much oriented by the web. And so, you know, we have about 3 to 5 million people come to the site every month. And they often come because they are, you know, in the store and they see some salmon on sale and they come home and think, how am I going to make the salmon? Or, you know, they see the salmon in the store and they think, oh, I want to read about the PCBs and all the mercury and, you know, problems that are going on with farmed fish, and they go to Epicurious. So what's great about it is it gives you this kind of, you know, in the moment, real-time way to advance and really promulgate your obsession. So that's what's fantastic about Epicurious.
And at the same time, you can just click through and see how Marcus Samuelson prepares gravlax.
Exactly. That's right. There's another way to see about salmon. I mean, we really try to kind of give everyone, whether it's recipes or information or videos or techniques, we try to kind of work all of the different ways of cooking and eating.
One of the things that's very interesting, I think, about that, in a way, there are some seeming contradictions that sort of work in the web's favor. One is, yes, it's very immediate, but the other thing is content can live forever. I mean, we have been doing this for 2 years. We have 220 shows on the web. You can go into epicurious.com and find an article that was written many months ago, whereas maybe if you got Gourmet Magazine, unless you're a pack rat and you keep all of your Gourmet Magazines, you can't refer to last Christmas's recipes. And, I mean, don't you think that's very interesting that there is this immediacy, but there's also this ability for stuff to live forever? If you see a page, you just click save on your browser and it stays in your computer forever?
That's true, and that's in some ways a little bit worrisome because, you know that this is kind of permanent for all time and you need to make it right the first time. But on the other hand, you've also got, you know, as you were talking about blogs, I have a blog called The Epilogue on Epicurious, and that is as immediate as you can get. You know, I can have my peanut butter and jelly sandwich and then blog about it 2 minutes later, and it's up on the web for millions of people to see. So it's a strange dichotomy.
I mean, that's really where I see the difference between magazine or where, you know, your publishing prior career and now your internet and your blogging, where something that you may work on for 3 or 4 weeks and get put in a magazine and then it's published 60 days later or 30 days later.
And then
later,
disappears off the stands 30 days after that.
To something where you're like sitting at your kitchen table and you're like, this could be across the World Wide Web in 15 minutes.
Yes, it's very scary. And in fact, when I first started at Epicurious about a year and a half ago, and I also just started my blog, I remember I wrote something, and then I decided, oh, you know what, I want to go back and refine it later. And I pressed the wrong button, and I set it out there, and I was horrified.
Whoops.
Yeah, it was so scary, and I was screaming. I had everyone around me like, I don't even know how to pull this back out, you know.
Get me the tech guy.
Yeah, help.
Well, you know, there's another interesting spot that Epicurious holds, and we found a similar thing with we've been amazed by what's happened with our podcast. I mean, it's gone across the world.
But I'm going to interrupt Francis for 1 second. Well, you know, Top Chef had that same kind of situation happen on their website. Something went out about, you know, who was potentially the winner of their last episode,
right,
prior to the episode going out. You know, you can pull it back, but a million people already saw it.
Yeah,
that's right.
Once it's out there, and it may be out there for all time. We'll come back in just a moment and talk more with Tanya Steele of Epicurious.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:24.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left, and, of course, Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, and we're talking with Tanya Wenman Steele, editor-in-chief of the award-winning Epicurious.com, which is Condé Nast's premier food website associated with Gourmet, Bon Appetit, and Self magazines. We were talking before the break about the intersection, especially in the food world, because food is such an immediate thing, and, you know, print media and things on the web. When we began, we started broadcasting at a local radio station, and sort of as a goof, we stuck things up on the web, and 70,000 listeners later, we get emails from all around the world, and we have listeners from all around the world. But one of the things we found when looking at podcasts and researching podcasts, because now, well, it's part of how we make our living and our passion, so we know more about it. We found that when you're podcasting what is also exists in the regular broadcasting world, people immediately assign you more legitimacy. And you also maybe have to meet a higher standard of quality or you'll never get broadcast on the air. But you get that extra cachet. We get that extra cachet because we are broadcast on AM radio. And I think that Epicurious.com, likewise, people trust you more because you are associated with Gourmet and Bon Appetit and Self. And there is a bricks and mortar cornerstone from which all that information emanates. Is being a Condé Nast website to Epicurious's mission and credibility?
It's a great question. I think that it's very important to have the Condé Nast and Condé Net name behind us. In terms of Gourmet and Bon Appetit, what is so great is that our recipes, we have 22,000 recipes that are professionally tested on the site, and the bulk of those are from Gourmet and Bon Appetit. But what is so fun for me is that I've been able to be given free rein to go and talk to, you know, Mariam Batali and all the top chefs around the country and around the world, and cookbook authors and bakers and all of these great people who are doing things and do
you
web
You left out radio show hosts.
And yeah. Radio show hosts. Oh, how silly of me. To do web-exclusive articles and stories for us. So that's, for me, that's been the fantastic thing. I mean, actually, Epicurious is now about 80 to 90% original content, excluding the recipes. So we're very much a food website on our own standing, and I think that's why we've gotten so many millions of people come every month and why we're winning awards. We're very lucky in that respect.
Well, you're lucky, and it's also a lot of hard work, and it absolutely fills a need. But I think that food people are very much warming to the idea of getting information over the net and reading those print publications over the net. And one of the things that is so nice about or so enjoyable about that is when you find an article on the web, you can email it to your friend. Mm-hmm. And you know,
sharing becomes much easier.
And that's how we grew. I mean, we don't have an advertising budget. We just grew virally. And I'm assuming that the same is true of Epicurious.
That's true. We're actually one of the first social networking sites out there. We started in 1995, and 1995 that started initially was that people could rate and review the recipes. So mm-hmm. now 90% of our recipes are rated and reviewed by at least an average of 14 people. So there are some recipes that have 800 reviews on them. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's very cool. But and speaking of iPods, one thing I did want to mention is something that we have podcasted as well as videos.
Hey,
on
you know
the
what?
Site.
We're gonna leave that as what we call in the restaurant business as a teaser for after the news. We're gonna take a break and we're gonna hear about what's going on in the world, and then we're gonna come back and fill in that teaser, and you can find out what's going on with Epicurious and podcasting and their webcast that you can find out about yourself. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every Monday to Friday from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Tanya Steele is editor-in-chief of the award-winning Epicurious.com, Condé Nast's premier food website, incorporating content from Gourmet, Bon Appetit, and Self magazine, plus tons of original content. They're one of the premier food websites. You can link to them through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. And today, Tanya joins us to talk about what's going on there. We talked before the news, Tanya, about, we podcast, you webcast as well. Tell us, other than print, what people can find that's interesting at Epicurious.
Well, one of the great things that we've just launched is something called Inside the CIA. We're the first people to ever be allowed within the hallowed halls of the Culinary Institute of America. And I know you're thinking the CIA like the agency, but but in the CIA, that means in the food world, the Culinary Institute, which I think is really kind of the Harvard of cooking schools. And we gave four students cameras and told them to go and shoot in their classes and when they're out of class and at competitions and all this great stuff. And so every week we're putting up a webisode, which is also a podcast, as well as text and video blogs from the four students. And it's going to be a 12 to 15 week series, and we're in week three, and we've got all the episodes for anyone who's missed them up on the site. And it has just been really fascinating for anyone who's really fantasized about becoming a chef or going to cooking school. This is a great window into what it's really like.
And that'll be interactive as well. You'll be able to blog and write emails to those students as well.
Yes, you can comment on their blogs and on their text and video blogs. We've got a little fan club going for some of them. It's very cute. so yeah, definitely, it's very interactive.
Why do you think the CIA did the CIA have any reservations about allowing this to happen in the school?
You know,
when the hazing incidents come out, it's going to be terrible, right?
All that cake frosting. Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
I was lucky in that I've known the people at the CIA for a long time, so it wasn't kind of coming out of left field. And also, I'm lucky that I had the name of Epicurious behind us. Mm-hmm. They were a little bit nervous because, obviously, this is unfettered access. We are giving these kids these cameras. So I think initially they were slightly nervous, but then they said, you know what, this is probably going to be great for us and great for people to see what it's really like, the successes and the failures and how it is grueling and yet incredibly exciting to be there as well. So far I think they've been pretty pleased with the results, and I know that we're getting tremendous traffic to it, so that's great.
Well, one of the things we know about Culinary Institute of America is that it's really hard.
Yeah.
And, the lives that they lead and the schedule that they have to keep is very difficult.
It is. In fact, if you're going into the baking program, mm-hmm. you have to get up at 2 in the morning to essentially bake all the goods for the students and be in bread class. And, they start at 3 in the morning for that class. So I think the schedules are essentially like 9 hours of classes, and there's competitions and exams on the side. And it is really kind of a back-breaking schedule. And I do think it helps to be young. We've got four young people here. But it is an amazing immersion into what it takes to be a world-class chef.
Tanya, I need to clue you in on one little thing, though. If you're like we are and you're in the restaurant business and in the culinary world, 2 a.m. means the end of the night, not the beginning.
Maybe. I remember there were days, I tell you, I view it as a personal failure. We started out as bartenders, and still one of my favorite things to do is 10 bar. We have a great cocktail program at one of our places. But I will tell you that I view it as a personal failure that I've not gotten out in time. If I run into the baker on the way out, the bartender side of the business is just the opposite. But it's funny. People don't, and the thing about CIA is that's very good because I get we get emails all the time, and actually Mark and I try to answer as many emails as we can. Actually, the volume's gotten too big, and we have some of our office staff answer some of them. But some of the emails that come through say, you know, I'm considering a career change. I'm successful this, and sometimes it's people who, you know, don't necessarily need the money, and I'm thinking about being a cook. I'm like, I hope that you, Mr. 40-year-old guy, are in better shape than I am, because the reality of cooking in a kitchen, or in many aspects of the restaurant business, is 12 and 14-hour days, and there are no breaks.
Very physical.
And the restaurant itself, you know, people wonder. We do a lot of restaurant consulting, and people put a restaurant together, and sometimes designers sort of dabble in restaurant design, and we'll say, you know, your designer, that door is never going to work. Well, why is that door never going to work? Because it's going to fall off the hinges. It's a household door. This is a restaurant, and restaurants, the building itself falls apart so quickly because, you know, the baker gets there at 4 in the morning as the bartender's leaving. That building is in use 24 hours a day.
We're going through that door 2,000 times a day, not 15.
Mm-hmm. And what's the reaction of Epicurious visitors to the webisodes?
So far, they've been extremely positive. So people have found it fascinating, and it's interesting to see whether people are asking for more of the in-class aspect or if they're into more of the kind of the outside the class. You know,
what are they asking for?
They're asking for both. I mean, right now it seems to be 50-50. So I can't tell if it's gender related or not, whether it's women asking for more of the actual class stuff and men are asking for more of the, I can't tell right now. So
You know what I think is very interesting about doing a webisode with this and CIA's position? I think it's very smart, and I'll tell you why it's very smart. I have an unhealthy addiction to YouTube, right? And every 20-year-old today has a cell phone camera. Okay.
Yes.
So sooner or later, there are all sorts of cameras inside.
Someone's
going to
be taking a picture of you doing something that you don't want to take a picture of. Is that where you're going?
But inside the hallowed halls of CIA, there are thousands of cameras, and I think it's great for you to sort of put this out there and present an image before, you know, the beer bong party is what's up on YouTube, and you can't really control that. You know what I mean?
That's true.
Now, do you edit the blogs? Do you have any editorial control over these kids' blogs, or is it just whatever they feel goes up there?
Well, sometimes we'll give them questions to ask them so that they have something to talk about if they feel like they don't have anything to talk about. Because, you know, they are filming all the time, so, you know, at a certain point they might feel brain dead and they just want to be asked a question.
Mm-hmm. They're also not journalists.
They're essentially kids out of school. So, we do edit the webisodes, the featured package of episode every week. And in terms of the video blogs, we will cut down, but that's as much as we will edit. So,
how did you pick the particular four kids to give cameras to and start this online web reality TV show series?
What we essentially did is we had a kind of an open casting call at the CIA around Thanksgiving and said, you know, we're doing this and anyone who's interested should send in their tapes. And so we literally got just hundreds of audition tapes of people just talking to the camera and showing us their houses, wherever they were, and saying, this is why I'm going to school and this is why I want to be a chef. And we just picked kind of the four of the most dynamic, interesting kids who are also articulate and not, you know, nervous about talking in front of a camera, obviously. So we did want to make sure we got two people from the culinary program and two from the baking, and we wanted to try to have two men and two women, and that's as much as we wanted to, you know, really editorialize. Other than that, we just looked for the most interesting people.
And they film, how much of the time is filmed?
They film all the time. I mean, I think all four film slightly you know, different amounts. I know one shoots way more than the other three because he used to dabble in film himself. But essentially, they're filming in their classes, almost every day, and they're filming in their rooms, and they're filming during their work when they have to work in the cafes or the kitchens or wherever. So they're filming a ton.
That's I think this is amazing. If you want to check it out and see what it's like to be inside the CIA from a reality TV show perspective in perfect short little bites, you can go to epicurious.com and check it out. We're talking with Tanya Steele. She's the editor-in-chief of epicurious.com. You can link to them through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And Tanya, when we come back after a short break, I want to talk with you about a book that's due to be released later in the year, Real Food for Real Kids. Can we chat about that?
Yeah.
It's a big issue for Francis and me.
Big issue for us. We'll be back in just a moment with more with Tanya Steele from Epicurious.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightsonnine.com. That's lightsonthenumber9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is Tanya Steele, editor-in-chief of the wonderful Epicurious.com, which you can find through our website. But let's come back to print media for a moment. Tanya, you've authored a book that's due for release any day now, actually later this year, called Real Food for Real Kids. Talk to us about Real Food for Real Kids.
Yeah.
Mark has some real kids.
Really?
And I'd like to give him some real food. Maybe
wow.
You can give him some pointers.
Actually, unfortunately, it's not going to be released until next spring now. But essentially what it is a gigantic cookbook, pretty much hopefully anything that you'll need to know about how to feed your kids, whether they're 6 months or 16 years old, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But the really cool thing that we did with this cookbook, it's got over 300 recipes, is that we had every single recipe tasted by a real kid. And there are comments from some of the kids on the cookbook pages themselves, from 3-year-olds and from 12-year-olds all over the country. And, you know, we really felt that it was important for them to give us feedback and to make sure that these are wholesome, healthy, you know, pretty easy recipes to make, but we wanted to make sure they were actually going to eat them. Otherwise, what was the point of doing this cookbook? So.
Well, now, let me – this throws out a broader question. Do you think kids should eat differently than adults in a family, or do you think that there should be one meal cooked for everybody and everybody should sort of chow into that meal?
I'm extremely against making two meals for separate members of the family.
I knew we liked you.
I have four kids. How do you feel about five meals?
How about you're gonna eat that until it's 9 o'clock at night? You're sitting at this table.
That's right.
But go ahead. I'm sorry we interrupted you. But talk to me about that.
Obviously, the younger you can start, the better off you are. But I think it's very important that we don't become a country of short order cooks, where you know we're making frozen pizza for one kid and hot dogs for another, and toast for a third or something. I mean, we really need to reinstitute the concept of this is dinner, and you're going to sit here, and we're going to have a nice conversation. And, you know, you might not always love every single thing on this plate, but I need you to try it. I need you to, you know, have some of it, and this is why you need to have it. And to explain over and over and over again that, you know, you want your kids you need to explain to them that you want them to be healthy and strong, mm-hmm. and this is how you do it, and also that they need to know that they need to try things at least 12 times for their palates to become attuned to it. And also they need to know that it takes 20 minutes for the stomach to tell the brain that it's full, so that we shouldn't be rushing through meals. And when kids, like I have twins, identical twins, and they're always asking me for seconds. And, so a little bit worrisome because they're nice, healthy, strapping young lads. And I always remind them, I'm happy to give you seconds, and I give them raw vegetables usually first. So that's their second helping is always healthy. And then if they want something naughty, then I will give it to them. But in general, I think there needs to be a real strategy in terms of how we do feed our kids, because it really does set up a lifetime of eating habits and also health issues.
Yeah, we had a doctor on by the name of Dr. Stephen Witherly. He talks a lot about a lot of these issues and exposing your kids to foods and even, you know, having them try it a few times.
He talks about how the brain processes tastes.
How fascinating.
And one of the things I found, too, that, yes, you're when your children taste things 10, 12 times, they start to develop a taste for it. The other thing is, if you explain these things to them, and I've got the number down, it's somewhere between 700 and 800 times they begin to understand that you know, you need to have a balanced diet.
But Stephen Witherly also showed Mark, I'm surprised you don't recall, he showed you, he talks about how the history of taste works across culture, physiologically, how it developed in humans as opposed to animals. It's amazing. And if you're interested out there in finding out about how that works, look for the Stephen Witherly show on our archives at restaurantguysradio.com. But one of the things he said is familiarity is very important. And if you see something enough times, you may think it's gross the first time you see it. But so what he's advised Mark to do, your kid had a problem with broccoli?
Yeah.
And what he did was he said, put broccoli on the plate. Don't make them eat it.
The mere exposure effect, it was called.
And so you put it on, you put broccoli on your daughter's plate how many times?
Oh, a lot.
How many times did you figure?
I don't know, 20.
And that now she likes broccoli, right? Mm-hmm. She just eventually, and you didn't force her, nothing like that, and eventually through the familiarity, she picked it up and tried it, and now she liked it. And Witherly says this works on he's a neuropsychologist. And isn't he a neuropsychologist, I think? And it works on a neuropsychological level. Really, really fascinating. But real food for real kids, you talk about real food that the whole family should eat that is pleasing to kids?
Yes, exactly. So essentially what is kind of a breakfast, lunch, and dinner approach with global recipes. So, you know, we have things from Vietnam and Thai and Southwest and basic American and all that kind of stuff. But we're going on the premise that the whole family is eating this, whatever it is.
Well, I think that my kids are going to have it a little bit tough because they better be ready for foie gras at 4 because that's what's going to be on the plate. That's all I have to know. Eat your caviar or you'll not have any part of it.
All my kids are different, but, you know, some of my kids at 4 would be ready for foie gras and some would think, what did you do to me?
Now, is real food for real kids, is that something that older kids can get involved in, like making the dinner?
Yes, we're going to have icons that denote which recipes are good for kids to make. Yep.
I have one of my godchildren and my nephew, Connell Francis, is actually a budding young chef. I'll have to get this book for him when it comes out, and we'll have to have you back on to talk about it when it's actually available for people to buy. Will you come back and talk with us at that time?
I would love it.
Well, Tanya, thank you so much for coming on the show. You've been great.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
And we will link epicurious.com from our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we're going to have Tanya back on to talk about real food for real kids when it's available. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, Steve Luff, and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Today we're talking with Tanya Steele of Epicurious.com.
You know, earlier in the show, Tanya was talking about, you know, the webisodes that they have for their new reality show based on, called Inside the CIA, based on students who are at the Culinary Institute of America. And she talked about, you know, how it's good that these students are young and energetic because it is a very, very difficult profession. And I joked that what we talk about in the restaurant business, we talk about long hours. But back in the day, not that long ago, when I went to the Fulton Fish Market, when Fulton was still at Fulton Street Fish Market, we would go to the fish market at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And that wasn't the beginning of our day. That
wasn't the end of our day.
That wasn't get up early and go work from 3 a.m. to 9 a.m. That was the conclusion of a day.
You mean show up for at 10 o'clock for the 11 o'clock radio show?
Show up at 10 o'clock for the 11 o'clock radio show. Do an 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock radio show. Open for lunch. Do work between lunch and dinner. Work the dinner hour. Go to New York. Have some dinner at some place at midnight or 1 o'clock. Go to the fish market at 2 a.m. Come back to the restaurant and go home at 5 a.m.
Come back to the restaurant. Unload the fish.
Unload
the
fish, of course. Of course. No, I left it on the truck in 140-degree weather and let it bake.
Why are you whining to our audience?
I'm not whining. I'm just saying that you one of the things, this is not all glamour and glory, and I think it's good that there's a show that shows that you better be dedicated to this profession if this is gonna be your profession, because the hours are long. It's hard. It's rigorous. Some days are 18, 20, 22 hours long.
And if you love it, it's you what I always say about, you know, we often are hired to talk to people who want to think about restaurants as a second career.
Mm-hmm.
And what we say to them in the end is, if you love it and you can't do anything else, then you have to, then the restaurant business is for you. But if you think you're going to do it like 6 hours a day, 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, it's not for you.
But there is no other high like being in your dining room on a busy, busy night, and everything's going well, and all the cogs are moving in motion together, and everybody's happy, and
well,
everybody's smiling.
There's one other guy like that. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.